The opinions expressed on all WRCA programs are those of the program producers and do not express the views of WRCA, its staff, or management. This is 1330 WRCA Watertown, Boston, a Beasley Broadcast Group station.
Good evening. Welcome to Tube Talk. You have reached the zenith of independently produced radio programming. Good music, interesting radio conversations, and the occasional old-time radio program. Thanks for tuning in tonight.
Dream when you're feeling blue. Dream, that's the thing to do. Watch the smoke rings rise in the air. You'll find your share of memories there. So dream when the day. Things never are as bad as they seem. So things never are as bad as they seem. So dream, dream, dream. If I don't see her each day, I miss her. Gee, what a thrill each time I kiss her. Believe me, I've got a case on Nancy with a laughing face. She takes the winter and makes it summer. But summer could take some lessons from her. Picture a tomboy in lace That's Nancy with a laughing face. Did you ever hear mission bells ringing? Well, she'll give you the very same glow. When she speaks, you would think it was singing. Just hear her say, hello. I swear to goodness, you can't resist her. Sorry for you, she has no sister. No angel could replace Nancy with a laughing face. Betty Grable, L'Amour, and Turner. She makes my heart a charcoal burner. It's heaven when I embrace my Nancy with a laughing face.
Well, weren't those two both very, very nice? Dream When You're Feeling Blue, a nice Frank Sinatra recording from 1945. And another 1945 recording, Nancy with the Laughing Face. And apparently Nancy with the Laughing Face was written for Frank Sinatra's wife, I believe, at the time. And what a nice mix of beautiful vocal work and lovely instrumentation. Isn't it nice to hear music that was recorded? Violins, violas, harps, pianos, just a very nice mix of some very nice, relaxing, gentle, peaceful music. Sitting here in the antique cozy radio parlor, the big RCA all lit up, the dial looks nice. We've got a nice fire in the fireplace. We've got the blackout curtains drawn, and we're going to have a little more music.
Stars with love beside us to fill the night with a song. We'll hear the sound of violins out yonder where the blue begins. The moon will guide us as we go drifting along. Can't we sail away? Daisy paddle over the rim of the hill. Can't we sail away on a little dream and settle high on the crest of a thrill. Let's build a stairway to the stars, a lovely stairway to the stars. It would be heaven to climb to heaven with you.
Glenn Miller with Ray Eberle on the vocal. That spent 4 weeks in the number one slot starting in June of 1939.
If they had ever told me how sweet a kiss could be, I would have said impossible, impossible for me. And if they said I'd find you beyond the rainbow's end, I would have said impossible, impossible, my friend, to dream about what might have been is strange enough for me. But now it seems I'm living in a dream too beautiful to be. If they had said a moonbeam could calm a stormy sea, I would have said impossible. But now at last I see that nothing is impossible if you are here with me. I would have said impossible, but now at last I see that nothing is impossible if you are here with me.
Mr. Smooth himself, Nat King Cole, with Gordon Jenkins conducting. Well, you know, I guess I should not have been surprised when I started to get a few emails. What happened to Danny Stiles? And what happened to the Magical Music Museum? And I have to say, I'm amazed at the impact that a man who's no longer alive can continue to have on so many people. Maybe I really shouldn't be that surprised. You know, the music Danny played is timeless. It's a reflection on the times it was produced in and the wonderful musicians who produced it. And, you know, the way in which Danny delivered that music was warm and informative. It was fun. He respected the music a great deal. He respected the audience. And for an hour or so, you could live in a world of musical civility, sophistication, and sometimes silliness. You know, the vicar of vintage vinyl would be thrilled that people still love the music and miss his presence on the air. Now, as one of his listeners said, he was an ambassador to the past. The little old guy who showed up at WNYC would load up his shopping cart full of LPs, bring them to the studio, which was really his altar for the great music, spin all those discs for us to hear. You know, and this was the guy who was asked how long he'd keep playing his music on the radio. He answered, until I'm dead. Which, unfortunately, came too soon this March. You know, Danny Stiles was an original. He was as unique as the music he played. His legacy is our musical heritage. And we try to pay a little tribute to that heritage here on this show. And I started listening to Danny right here on WRCA. I was marveling at some of the stuff he had one night when he had a piece where Frank Sinatra was handing off the vocal baton to Dick Hames for the Harry James Band, and I was just wondering to myself, where does this guy get this stuff? You know, and after that, it was always a treat to hear Danny. He shared his knowledge of music and his record collection with us intimately each night he took the microphone. And from what I understand, you know, he really feared, he lived in fear that this music might fade away when he wasn't there to play it. But I don't think it will. You know, I hear from folks who go to great lengths to listen just to this program. You know, they'll pick it up on the computer, get it to an AM home transmitter, and then transmit it to an old vintage radio so they can hear it through the throat of an old Philco. And this music still has an audience, maybe small but dedicated. And I think much of the spirit that motivates people to honor the music is the same spirit that motivates the radio collector to keep the tubes glowing and the sounds from the vintage speakers alive. And when I first approached this station about doing a vintage radio collector music program, it was mentioned to Danny Stiles, and he was pleased that, you know, just somebody was thinking about keeping the music in the feel of those days alive, and, you know, that pleased me a great deal. So hello, 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 my hearties, and welcome to the American Museum of Natural Historical Records. You know, we can still hear Danny and the music he played on different stations that still offer him a home, including right here on WRCA. So, so long, old pal, Dean of Deja Vu, Vicar of Vintage Vinyl, Archangel of the Archives, Great Guru of Golden Gramophones, Didactic Doctor of Dreamy Discology. See you at the Red Jacket Club. And I tell you all, take a good listen when you can still hear him, because you will not hear another the likes of him. We're very happy here at Tube Talk to be joined once again by Mark Oppitt from the Michigan Antique Radio Club, Media Director. And we had Mark on before, and we had extensive agenda of things to cover, and we're going to cover what we missed. So we're going to make up for what we didn't quite cover the last time. And I did actually get some good feedback, Mark. A lot of people enjoyed your story about having to follow somebody to find radio. So they're out there and they're listening. So thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you. Those stories are always fun, and I always enjoy hearing them from other collectors at the shows.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes I'm more interested in the hunt, you know, the stories behind them than sometimes the actual sets themselves. So, but to kind of pick up,
as far as finding radios goes, there's a lot of things that collectors can do to make them come to them. That seems to be what happens to me more often than not. The radios find me, and I don't have to go looking for them.
Now, well, maybe you can fill us in on some of your techniques then to have them follow you like the Pied Piper, because I'd like to hear some of those. I mean, I do know that some people, you know, will put up an ad. You know, they'll put up an ad in Antique Radio Classified, or maybe they'll put an ad in their bulletin for their local radio club. What are some other ways that we could find some radios?
Well, those are methods of fishing in the well-fished pond. What you usually want to do is fish in the other pond where it's not overfished. So One of the things, the first thing to do is make up some good flyers that actually have some easy to see pictures or line drawings of the kind of things you're looking for. Because a lot of people, when you say an old radio, they really don't have a clear picture of exactly what you might be looking for. One of the books out there is called A Radio Collector's Directory and Price Guide. I think it's published by George Fathauer, formerly of Antique Radio Classify or Antique Radio Supply out in Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Antique Electronics Supply.
AES. AES.
AES. Correct. Yep. Has a book with some really great simple line drawings, and if you ask him for permission, he'll allow you to use them. They photocopy very clearly, and they represent just about every style of radio there is, from breadboards all the way up to transistor radios. So that's a good thing to use on your flyer, and you put on your flyer exactly what you're looking for, maybe some brand names or whatever. Keep it very, very simple, and I print it on a colored piece of paper, a bright neon green or bright neon orange, something like that, that when it gets thrown in somebody's pile on their on their workbench,
attention grabber,
out.
Yep.
Right. Then what you do with that is make sure you put some tear-off tabs on the bottom and also your phone number on the flyer itself, so when the tear-off tabs are gone, they still have a contact phone number. But I take those out if I go to any yard sale, garage sale, or anything like that. You get there early and you hand one to the people and you ask them if they would just, first off, they don't have anything. I always ask them if they would just leave it on the table. And that way, everybody that goes to that yard sale that day sees it, and if they want, they can tear off a tab. So that's, you're multiplying your contacts
right
by doing that. Same thing, go to shows that are frequented by people who have similar interests, and most of the electronics field is populated by guys who are also interested in cars or gun shows, hunting shows, things of that nature. And any show like that will also have a flyer table, you'll notice.
You know, I've done the business card routine where I'll have a few cards, try to keep them always in my wallet. And if I'm around town or, I stopped in this little, it was a doodad kind of bordering on almost a junk shop once. And the woman had opened up a couple of other little tables in her store, and she had a kid in there who was doing wood refinishing, and he was taking a break, but I was talking to his mother, and she says, "Oh, do you need woodwork or this or that?" And I said, "Well, that's not really, my bag, but I collect radios." I gave her my card. And she goes, "I might have something you're interested in." And I get a call about 3 weeks later. She had a transoceanic that was sitting on a shelf in her closet for the last 28 years.
Sure.
And, it's maybe a good thing that her kid went out to take a cigarette break because I walked in and essentially for beer and pizza money for him, I was able to relieve him of that. But
right.
I think
cards are great for one-on-one personal, communication. But what I'm talking about with the flyers is a bit like broadcasting.
Right.
You're putting them out in places where a lot of people are likely to see them, but you're also putting them in key locations
right
where people who are already pickers are frequenting.
Yeah, like as they would say in the ad business, multiple impressions.
Exactly. But not only that, but targeted multiple impressions.
Yes. And, it's interesting because I just read on the Philco forum of a guy who goes to car shows in Hershey,
mm-hmm,
in Pennsylvania, and he's done quite well picking up radios at car shows.
Yep.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
Maybe he could go get a car at a radio show.
Anything
next
that's
time.
An adjacent, what I call adjacent hobbies. So gun and knife shows, outdoorsman shows. These are guys who typically have garages full of stuff, and that's the kind of person you want.
There are these guys too, like for example, we have a meet coming up here with the New England Antique Radio Club just about the end of the month, and a lot of guys will come who are collectors, and they bring some of their stuff they're trying to move or offload, or they don't have room for, or they're restored. So there's always the collector community, but I don't know their names, but there's about six or eight guys who I come all the time, and these are guys who are out trolling yard sales, estate sales. They go to all the little mom-and-pop antique stores. And what they do is they go to the radio show. Then they go to the furniture show. And what they'll try to do is they know that twice a year they can always go and bring whatever they can find for old radios to this club meet, and they're going to find people who are going to be willing to at least look at them and in a lot of cases buy them. So they're out there doing a lot of the legwork for you, and they're going to bring it right to the, you know, to the meet for you. And that can be a nice way to kind of ease putting a lot of miles on your car too.
Yes, but like I said, a flyer at a yard sale is going to be seen by maybe 25 to 50 people.
Oh, and put them up everywhere. Put them up at ask your barber. Ask, you know, any place you might go where you know that there's a crowd.
Around here, you rarely see bulletin boards anymore. They used to have them at shopping at supermarkets and such. Most of them are gone these days, but the hardware stores tend to still have them. So you can usually find them there. Also, any kind of trades places like lumber stores, places like that tend to have them, and they'll have a bulletin board full of cards of contractors and things of that nature.
Yeah, you find it at lunch places too. You know, where a lot of the working guys go to grab lunch. You can find your painter, your plasterer. Yes. You can find your landscaper's cards. You can find all that stuff up there.
Another thing to do is flyer your garbage man. I've done this, and for years there was a garbage guy in Detroit that would save stuff for me. He'd call me up every so often when he had a pile of stuff.
Well, that's an interesting idea. That's something you don't usually think about.
No, when the garbage man comes down the street, try to get him, throw the flyer in there and say, hey, tear off some of these tabs and give them to the other drivers, and you guys might find something golden. Another thing is flyer plumbers. Plumbers and electricians go in a lot of homes. A
lot of basements.
Yes, and some of the biggest collectors in this area. I know a very well-known collector that's since passed away that was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, had a huge collection of radios and phonographs from the pre-1930 era. He was into those Nickelodeons and all kinds of things. Anyways, he was a plumbing inspector or electrical inspector. So he would typically go into basements, people's homes, and look at after electrical work had done. He would inspect the panel. Well, all he had to do was turn his head around a little bit and see whatever was there.
Well, you know that those are situations I can personally relate to because I got two examples. One is my father was one of 13 kids. Six of his brothers were plumbers.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for the Edison Company up here. So between them all, and especially my father, he was always bringing stuff home. And actually, a radio that I got restored that I had sitting on a shelf for years and years and years is one my father pulled out of a guy's basement. It was a 1946 wood cabinet RCA, and it's a neat set, and it has a little sentimental value too. But he found it going down somebody's basement to check for trouble. Here it is. And, you know, the guy was thankful that he got his lights back on, and he said, oh, you know, do you listen to this? Oh, no, would you like to take that? Here you go, you know, and off he went.
The best finds I've had overall were, because I'm a servicer, I'm always looking for parts. And that's my specialty is parts. And for years I went to, I got a list of all the service shops in Detroit way back in the 80s when there were still a lot of them around. And I went around and flyered all those places, and I did get the chance to go in and buy out large quantities of parts from radio and TV shops, some of which went all the way back to pre-World War II. But also there were, what would happen, let's say some guy had a service shop in the 30s, he would live until the 70s or 80s and pass away. But before he passed away, he would close the shop and work out of his home for several years. So now the only person that knows the stuff is there is his widow and or, you know, any other relatives.
Right.
So those are people that are hard to connect with. You got to think of, well, where would that person ever see, you know, my name? And, of course, you have to do some advertising. But one thing is those penny saver flyers or coupon packs around here are called Val packs, and they get mailed personally, so they to the locations of homes, and you can actually buy an ad in one of those things for about $400. Now you say $400 is a lot of money to spend, but you get like about 10,000 pieces mailed directly to homes. But here's the secret. Split it with somebody else who's in a non-related hobby. So let's say you got some guy that's into collecting golf collectibles or somebody who's looking to buy fishing equipment. If you have a couple buddies, split one of those ads three ways. You each spend about $100 and a quarter, $150 And that's a real good way to reach people who are in their homes who maybe don't go out to any shows and maybe they don't look in the classifieds.
That's right. Somebody who's going to recognize it's a radio, but maybe not much more than that and really isn't going to know how to touch base with somebody in the community. You know, one of the topics you had emailed me was, and I was kind of curious about this because I don't know the answer myself. What was the most valuable vintage radio and what was the most ever paid for one? So if you have an answer for me on that one, I'd love to hear it.
Well, the two most valuable ones that stand out by quite a long shot are the Zenith Stratosphere, made in 1935, 36, and 37.
25-tube model, right?
Correct. Stand upright console with no phonograph, of course, just a radio, multi-band radio, and collector. And there were several versions of them. They aren't really all exactly the same, but they are all 25-tube, two-chassis radios. There's an upper chassis and a lower chassis. And they have multiple speakers in them, and it's quite a thing to have. In addition to that, there's a thing called a Scott Quaranta, which is a 48-tube radio. Not very many were made, I believe. They were because Scott radios were mostly custom-made anyway. This was a custom-made radio. I think they only made about three of them, and I'm not sure they had complete cabinets for all of them. But I believe there's one complete one known to exist and two others that are partially complete. But the other radio that sells for very high dollars, an Art Deco mirrored radio made by Spartan.
Yep, Jackson, the Bluebird.
Michigan. And, well, there's the Bluebird is the table model, but they made a console version with an 11-tube radio.
Yep, I've seen that. Yep. It's a very funky looking thing.
Yeah, it stands on a metal chrome frame. And the mirror is round, and it's about maybe three and a half feet in diameter. I've seen one in person before. I don't recall where it was at one of the shows. I think it could have been Elgin back many years ago. But they're very pretty, very Art Deco. I suspect they were only sold in the East Coast and perhaps to people living in Florida around you know, Miami, the Art Deco capital of the world, or perhaps California. It would be pretty rare, I would think, to turn one up in the middle part of the country. But
any idea what those went for?
I think one of those in beautiful condition sold for over $50,000.
Wow.
The Zenith Stratosphere, I think the highest one known to sell sold for around $80,000.
Wow.
And those are pretty reliable numbers, from what I recall.
That's pretty impressive.
Now, the Zenith Stratosphere actually sold, I believe the number of them made was somewhere in the range of 500 pieces were originally made. And today there's over 100 of them known to exist, I believe, or right around 100.
I always see Alan Jesperson's ad in you know, Northern Radio's Wanted.
Yes.
Wanted,
yes.
Dead or alive, any condition, call me.
Any condition, right. Well, there's parts of certain ones around, and, you know, because they got some of them got taken apart and people discarded the cabinets. So there's, as is the case with Scott radios, you know, for every 100 Scott chrome chassis radios like the Philharmonic, for every 100 of them, there's barely 50 cabinets existing, and beyond that, there's barely maybe 30 speakers. So the speakers are the rarest, and the cabinets are next rarest, and chassis are relatively plentiful.
And one of the other things you were threw out there was what do collectors of today want? What's hot? What's not? What are people looking for? So maybe give us an idea what's being what's highly sought after these days, at least in the circles you travel in.
Well, the most popular to this day still is the Zenith brand, and the big black dial radios seem to be the hottest thing overall, especially in the tombstone styles, which are the tall table models. But the certain console models sell very, very well. Beyond that, there's always interest in the Catalan plastic radios, even though I think it's diminished somewhat from its peak, maybe in the 90s. But they're still very popular because of the bright colors that they were made in and the Art Deco kind of modern styling that they had. Beyond that, it broadens out quite a bit. There's a lot of activity in a lot of different directions. You had the transistor radios that became very, very popular, the early transistor pocket radios, especially the Japanese ones, became very hot collectibles in the 90s. I think they've died down somewhat, but one thing I think I see more interest coming along more and more is in television. There seems to be more and more people looking at collecting televisions, even though they're extremely hard to restore if you have a bad picture tube.
They can be hard to find room for, too, especially some of the cabinets on some of the older ones.
Well, the early color sets have a very high interest level. And there's the Early Television Foundation in Ohio. I think it's near Columbus, if I'm remembering right. It's called ETF, the Early Television Foundation. And they are, I don't know how many members they have, but they have a nice museum there. And they have a conference every April, I believe it is.
Well, for me at least, and maybe it's because not that I'm a complete klutz, but, I mean, if I was going to invest some serious bucks in a Catalan set, or if I had, I'd want to put that thing under a bomb-proof glass case, and, a lot of the Catalan collectors don't even, would never even think of wanting to play the radio. They're basically there for physical appearance, for aesthetics. But even like you were mentioning the Spartan Bluebird console model, even something like that, I'd live in, unless I had that thing encased somehow, I'd live in deathly fear of, chasing the cat and stumbling over the, oh, there it goes, no.
By the way, the console model is called the Nocturne.
The Nocturne.
Yes. And the Bluebird is the table model. I have one of those, and those are not extremely hard to find. And the reproductions of those are quite good looking, by the way.
They're popular. I mean, people like that because it's a very pretty accent piece. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what a vintage radio guy might think about the electronics and the repros. Out of all the repros, they're probably pretty sharp looking, and they seem to sell. I can remember as a kid, I used to see those sell. Yeah, and some of the catalog stores that used to carry those.
I don't know if they're still available currently, but I'm sure they're out there on eBay or on Craigslist. But the reproductions have FM on them, of course. The originals had AM and shortwave only.
Now, something else we were going to talk a little bit about was Mystery from World War II. And I've mentioned shortwave before on the program, and, shortwave was an amazing phenomenon in its day in that, the broadcast band certainly was there, but the shortwave became popular at about the same time so many different events were transpiring, especially in Europe, that people were interested in. It was a marketer's dream to have shortwave sets, and you have all of this different stuff going on in Europe. Who wouldn't want to listen to the BBC, or who wouldn't want to try to pick up Berlin? And you could do a whole show on it on its own. We've talked a little bit about that before, too. Just, the war broadcasts alone would be mesmerizing to listen to. But you were also talking about the number stations that repeat numbers. And what's the story behind that?
Well, I don't exactly know the whole story. They're not necessarily tied into World War II. I'm not even sure when they began. I think they began later.
Shortwave phenomenon, though?
Yes, on shortwave.
It was a shortwave.
Yes, and you can still find them, and it's just a voice. It'll be either male or female voice repeating numbers, seemingly random numbers. And they can be in English, or they can be in other languages. If they're in English, I think most of the time there's some sort of an accent with the voice, but they just repeat numbers almost endlessly. Some of them, I think, might even be automated, and so you'll just hear this voice saying 7, 9, 18, 4, three, like that.
That's kind of crazy. You know, and it's funny because occasionally I'll visit this website, the Fedora Lounge, which is sort of this very retro vintage website, and they talk about lots of different topics. Right. And I clicked on the button for radio, so I'm looking through some of the radio comments, and here's this guy who was, gee, he said, you know, I was listening on a shortwave radio, and he was saying he still heard these numbers. And this was a fairly recent post, so I guess they're still out there. I don't know if they're on one wavelength more than another, but that's just sort of an interesting thing.
What frequencies they're on or whether they've been traced very well, you know, as to where they are originating. There was a fairly good article one time. I think it was an Antique Radio Classified. It might have been in some others, but probably if you just did a Google search on the internet for the numbers stations and the word shortwave, you would probably turn up the article.
Well, you know, it sounds like a good topic for an Art Bell show, you know. I mean, something.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
That's him in his retirement. Maybe that's him somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
He's got his list.
The other mystery I think I mentioned to you before was the mystery of the disconnected shortwave on radios during this is the story that I've heard is that during World War II, certain people living in the United States had to bring their radios in and have the shortwave disabled because they were considered to be maybe people who shouldn't be hearing.
Right, for some reason, a threat or
news.
Right,
right. So this was a story that I've heard many times, or, you know, not many times, but a few times from different people. And it started years ago when I was in high school. A guy who was sort of one of my mentors mentioned it. He was originally from Lebanon, but he had moved to the United States, in the 60s. But he grew up, in the overseas, but he had heard the story too. And then I got contacted by one of the producers for this Histories Detectives show that's on PBS, and they said that they had heard this story as well, and they were thinking of doing a show on it, and they wanted to know if I had any inside information. I said, well, no, I really don't. I've heard it many times. I'll try and do some extra checking on it for you and get back to you. Well, they had gotten the initial inquiry from somebody in this area, in the Detroit area, that had a radio that they claimed had the shortwave disabled during World War II because their uncle was Italian or something.
Right, right.
And he was considered some sort of not an illegal alien, but
I understand. Somebody who may pose a risk of some type.
Yeah.
You know, it maybe not be that far a stretch here in Boston, right down by, it's called Black Falcon Terminal now. It's down by the waterfront, and they use it as a cruise port now. But during the war, we have a fairly large Italian-American community in the north end of Boston, and, you know, it still has a very heavy Italian flavor to it, though not as many, Italian-Americans live there. But they would inter, even on a temporary basis, a pretty significant number of Italian POWs from time to time at this facility, which was a Navy facility in its day. And there were issues with the local Italian community who would want to go down, and they'd try to get up, close to, the fencing, and they'd want to try to find out, where was somebody from? Did they know a relative? Swapping information, throwing food over the fences, and, it's legitimate stuff. So, it may have been innocent enough that they would want to have shortwave capability to listen. But on the other hand, you never know. And fifth column activity, certainly existed. It's not something you can deny. So
there seems to be a lot of holes in the story, though. Well, first of all, I'll tell you the situation with the person who inquired from the Detroit area. They asked me to go check it out. So I went to the home. They had a couple old radios, actually, and one of them was a 1937 era RCA console. And they said, this is a radio we think, had the shortwave.
Right, was disabled,
connected. So I pulled the chassis on it, and sure enough, somebody had been working in there and dinked around with it, but it actually had like a 1960s era oscillator coil stuck in it and some pretty unprofessional looking work. So I surmised that the thing had been played around with in the 60s, and I didn't see anything in there that looked like, you know, World War II vintage servicing.
Yeah.
So I sort of put the kibosh on that one and said, I think this was screwed around with later. Anyways, I did put a call into a couple of our other elder statesmen of the Michigan Antique Radio Club. One is Paul Colissimo, who still operates an antique radio repair business in the Detroit area, Melvindale. And he's 94 years old, I believe.
God bless him.
God bless him. He still runs. He's at his shop, I think, 4 or 5 days a week.
Good for him.
Still. And a great old guy. And I put the question to him. I said, Paul, did this happen during World War II? And he said, oh, yeah, it did. I said, well, did you, you know, were you working in a service shop then? Oh, yeah, sure. I said, well, how was this administered? Who told these people to bring their radios in, or did you know what was the story? He said, "I don't know. I just remember the boss told us to do it."
Huh.
So,
well, you
I
guess on the other hand, you know, the hole in this whole thing would be, you know, say you got a letter from the State Department, or somebody came and said, "Hey, pal, you have to take this down to the shop." You know, and you brought it down and they disabled it for you. But who's to say you wouldn't have a friend who was, you know, technically adept, who'd come over after it all tied down and get you going again on shortwave? So.
Oh, sure. You could go out and you couldn't buy a new radio, but you could easily get one secondhand.
Right.
Or,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't seem to hold a lot of water. The other thing is how would it have been administered? Like, after the, how would anybody know whether or not the work was really done?
Right.
There must have been some sort of paperwork or a sticker or, you know, I mean, there had to have been some documentation. I've never seen a label on a radio that says, you know, this radio, the shortwave was disabled in compliance with regulations.
Yeah, warning, do not enable shortwave capability.
Yeah, or, you know, something. You know, the government loves stickers, and you would have thought there would have been one applied to any radio that would have had that work done.
Yeah, it could be in the urban myth category, I think, with that one. I don't know.
That's exactly. Well, the other thing I'm thinking, this is my own conjecture here, is that possibly some of the immigrants that came over actually had to have it done in Europe at one time.
Right, and they brought the story with them.
At the beginning of the war, and they fled Europe, they came over here, and they told this story. And it got transposed into the kids hearing the story and thinking it had been done here and not over there.
That's a good conjecture. I mean, we had Ross Hochstrasser in here one day, and he's up on a lot of different European makes, and we were talking about this and that, and we were talking a little bit about the you know, the German you know, sort of the people's radios that were sold during Germany, which basically would just allow you to listen to the propaganda as opposed to listening to the BBC. And he did mention to me, though, that it, you know, with the fair degree of certainty, that, you know, the Germans did have vans, they had trucks, and they would go out and actively look for folks who were trying to listen to shortwave. And you know, they were concerned, was it an underground, was it somebody who was an enemy of the government, and they would actively try to track people down. So,
well, you can sort of course track radios by listening for the oscillator frequency of the radio.
He said they had these trucks and they were equipped to do that, so you know,
though the radio is not a transmitter per se, if you have highly directional antennas, you could listen for you know, the signal that would be radiated by the radio, which is why, you know, Scott Radio Labs made those special radios. They called them morale receivers for the Navy and for the Army that could be listened to by the troops or by anyone, and they were specially designed so as not to radiate any energy whatsoever that could be traced.
Well, that's pretty cool. That's something you don't usually think about. You know, one other thing, and we're going to try to spend a few minutes here on Philco, but another comment, and just, you know, we talked a little bit last time you were on about performance, and we talked about sound of vintage equipment, And performance from a sort of, you know, we call it in the hobby, if you're not a radio person, DX, you know, long distance listening. I have an interesting DX report I want to submit to the DX department here. There's a show that, for programming reasons, no longer on after this one. It's Danny Stiles. He does this old music program, and they're fairly popular. He has a pretty loyal, even though he's passed away, has a pretty loyal listenership. So they broadcast them still out of WNYC in New York City, 8:20 a.m., 1,000 watts a.m. at night. So I'm up here in Boston. So I said, well, you know, I logged onto the computer, and, yep, they're playing Danny Stiles. So I said, well, you know what, let's go check this out. So on a six-tube AC-DC RCA set, I managed to get 8:20 a.m. in last Saturday night good enough that there were chunks, 10, 15-minute chunks, when it was very listenable. It was not all scratch and garble and fade and hiss. And I said, wow, you know, for us. And a lot of people kind of, you know, especially guys who collect larger sets and really look for sort of the showpiece sets for the collecting, you know, to kind of look down their noses at some of the 5 and 6 tube sets. I said, that's pretty impressive, you know, I thought, for something that was that small to be able to do that for
you
me.
You know, but, I saw a little loop antenna by a company called Turk.
Turk, yep. I have one, yep. Inductive, yep. Those are neat.
Called the AM Advantage.
Exactly.
And it's totally passive. It doesn't have any amplifier in it whatsoever. It's just a tuned, you know, what you call a tank circuit. It's a capacitor and a coil. And the coil is the antenna. It's about 10 inches in diameter, 9 inches, I think. And it's got a nice rubber base on it, so you can set it on top of your radio and not scratch it up. And you put it in line. If you have a loop antenna on the back of an AC-DC radio, you can put it on top of the radio right near the back, and it'll couple to that antenna without hooking up any wires.
Yep.
And it really does a bang-up job.
Yep. Because I had to drag mine out. It was funny that you said that, because I dragged mine out, and then I popped that. I kind of fiddle around with the positioning so I get the maximum gain on it.
Yep.
And, you know, well, it started to sound a little bit like a local, but, you know, then, you know, either the atmospherics or the weather got me, and it started to go out on me a little bit. But, you know, it's a tribute to some of the engineering and some of this stuff that, you know, you can still have a lot of fun picking up radio stations, because I know it's a lot of people think it's just so passe now in the internet age, and we don't even want to listen to the radios anymore. So,
well, unfortunately, for the vast majority of the public, that's true. But
not for us.
not for us fans of old radio. Another thing with that antenna, I was going to say, we mentioned transistor radios earlier. Zenith had the Royal 500 series, which was their first transistor radio. And they brought that out in 1955, right after the Regency TR-1s came out, which is usually acknowledged to be the first American-produced transistor radio. Which, by the way, beat the Japanese by a year.
Yay!
Or so. But anyways, the Royal 500s were pretty good radios, and as time went on, they kept revising them, so collectors will call them the 500A, the 500B, the 500C and D and E, which actually Zenith did use the letter codes on some of them. Anyways, you get up to the last one that they made was an oval speaker version, and it's called the 500H. And it has a vernier tuning knob on it, which is pretty easy to use. It has this oval speaker. What's really unusual about it, by the way, is you look at the grill on the radio, and it has an oval with a dot with a medallion in the middle. But in reality, the oval speaker has an off-center voice coil. And there's a unique reason for that, is that they were trying to get half of the speaker to act like a woofer and half of it to act like a mid-range. And it actually does. It sounds really sweet.
Oh, that's cool.
Now, these radios are pretty common. You can buy them everywhere on eBay and such for a decent black. The black is the common color. You can buy a decent used one for about $40. They take 4 AA batteries. Usually all you have to do when you get one is shoot the volume control with some cleaner and work it
and
in.
And you're good to go.
And clean the battery terminals, and you're usually good to go. But anyways, the thing about these radios are darn sensitive.
Good performance.
They're really, really sensitive. The one drawback to them is that the dial is not very accurately calibrated, so you really can't pick out the frequency. you have to hunt for. You have to find a station that you know the frequency of and then go north or south of that, because the dial numbers are just not that well marked off. But if you take one of those radios and a Turk antenna, I like to say that you can put that up against almost anything.
That's impressive.
And that combination, and by facing the antennas and the radio different directions, it's incredible what you can get on any night. It's just amazing. You can just about log a station on every 10 kilocycle notch on the dial.
That's cool. Well, you know, we're watching the clock here, and, you know, it's funny. We try to catch up on what we missed last time, and we're still going to have a little catching up to do, because we're going to talk about Philco and what happened to Atwater Kent, because that's something we need to cover some more. And the other thing that I wanted to go over a little bit, and I've seen some people who had an interest in this, is some more discussion about somebody who might want to stream a show on the radio, something like this one, on their computer, and then bounce it through a little home transmitter setup and listen on some of their vintage equipment. So we're going to put those topics, as they say, in the business meetings in the parking lot. And Mark Oppett, thanks again for being on. I appreciate it. And we'll have you on again, and we'll cover some more, because there's just an awful lot to go over with this stuff. We appreciate you sharing some of your knowledge with us. Have a great night, Mark.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
Good night.
Sometime I'll be with you to change your name to mine. One day in May I'll come and say, happy the bride that the sun shines on today. What a wonderful wedding there will be. What a wonderful day for you and me. Church bells will chime, you will be mine in apple blossom time. I'll be with you in apple blossom time.
Then what will you do?
Then I'll be with you to change your name to mine.
When will that be?
One day, maybe in May.
Then what will you do?
I'll come and say to you, dear, happy the bride that the sun shines on today. Then what? One day in May. What a very, very wonderful day for you and me, dear. Church bells will chime, you will be mine. When? In apple blossom time.
Thanks for listening to Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, AM 1330. We have an email for the show, tubetalk1@gmail.com. tubetalk1@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Have a great night.
a member of the Beasley Broadcast Group. This is 1330 WRCA, Watertown, Boston.